We've been considering the point that Paul's been making, the point here that if we are part of Christ, if we, in other words, let me start back and say that the really essential point with Christ is that he rose from the dead. Had Christ merely come as a religious leader and died and been buried and been only an inspiration, I'm sure that I wouldn't be involved in this thing, and probably many of you wouldn't either. I'm not given to following religious leaders per se. It's got to be a lot more dynamic than that, because the world is full of religious leaders. You've got Muhammad and the Buddha and just dozens, in fact, hundreds of rather prominent religious leaders in the world, past and present, who have brought together a considerable following. That's why I picked out people like Buddha or Confucius or Lao Tzu or some of these men, these beings, Muhammad, human beings, who did put together a considerable following. But after all, since there are hundreds of these types of people, it's quite a fair question to ask, why should I believe in Muhammad, or why should I believe what Buddha said? Why believe any of these people if they're only leaders? Now, if Jesus had died and all we had was a book full of very excellent teachings, I'd forget it, because I'm not that interested. But the impact of the Spirit of Christ since he rose from the dead is different. Now, you see, Buddha never claimed to rise from the dead. Muhammad never claimed that. No one ever, I mean, his followers didn't even claim it for him. No one of the significant religious leaders of the world have claimed, or their followers have not claimed, that they rose from the dead. But Jesus not only made that claim, but the claim has got to be backed up. There are people who emerge on the religious scene today that claim to be reincarnations of one or another of the great leaders. But I don't pay too much attention to them, because I'm a pragmatist. I'm a practical person. I'm a hard person to convince. I'm not a credulous type of person. So the impact of a risen Christ upon my own life has been beyond the rationale, the reason that says to me, because he rose from the dead, I ought to believe in him. It's deeper than that. If someone asks me, how can you prove Jesus rose from the dead? I have to say to you, I really can't. I can't prove that. But the Bible makes that claim, you see. I have seen the rationale. That is, I've seen the logic, given the basic premise of the Bible, given what I have seen to be the possibility of God's revelation to us, to man, then I open up my mind to the possibility that Christ rose from the dead. I open myself to that possibility, and then I find that, as a matter of fact, the effect is there. Something is compelling us to believe that goes beyond our mind. So what is it that ties me to Christ, for example? What ties you to Christ? The only one thing, the power of the Spirit. Given the fact that there are thousands of religious views and claims in the world, given the fact that the resurrection from the dead violates the normal processes of reason, given all the scientific data that we have today that gives us at least some possible alternative to God and the universe, given all that stuff, a rational person might well question whether Christ rose from the dead, but the impact is there. And I see it not only at work in my own self, but in the lives of people that we deal with. That is why I rarely would get into an argument with anyone to try to prove to them that God exists or that Christ rose from the dead, because my job is to declare this revelation and to declare this truth. The Bible never argues the point whether God exists or not. It just states that God exists. And if there's not enough spiritual magnetism in him to hold us, we're certainly not going to stay because of reason. A lot of ways I would see myself as, well, I wouldn't want to say trapped. It's a little harsh, but stuck with it.
There's no other way. See, nothing else works. See?
So I have to come back again and again. And one might get a look at the thing going on in the world and be a little bit unhappy about the way things have gone. You say, well, how come, God, that goes like this? But still, knowing the way it goes, you still can't get away much from God. you're there. And nothing else makes sense, or nothing else really works. Well, we were just reading today in the Time magazine about these black holes out in space, which are probably, although it's still speculative, disintegrating stars, where the force, pressure is so great that it just, according to the theory at least, totally evaporates all the substance that was there and makes an impenetrable barrier for... it locks in whatever is left so that we can't really get in and find out. Now, how do they know that there was something there in the first place? Because of the effect of the gravitational pull on the surrounding elements, that's how. It's just like with a neutron. Nobody ever saw a neutron yet. It's what we call submicroscopic. You can't even see it in a microscope. How do they know it's there? Because there is a blue trajectory, a trail that follows the neutron as it passes through the cyclotron or synchrotron. They've got the cyclotron and synchrotron, two different units. Synchrotron is the later, more sophisticated thing. And I've seen it, the synchrotron. I was worked over at Caltech a little bit. With the mass spectrometer over there, working in the geophysics lab. I didn't have anything to do with it, but I knew, I've been in there in the building. A synchrotron is there, which is as big as probably the lower floor of this hotel building, this unit of the hotel. And all of that to split an atom. But still, they can't see the elements that they get from the splitting of that atom, except the trail that it leaves, the trajectory. Now, when people make a consistent application of the truth of God, that is, when they consistently are exposed to the truth of God, something begins to take place. I don't mean any great feelings, but there's a pull there, you see. There's a gravitational pull. There's something there that says, wait a minute, this is different. This is not just Hare Krishna or Scientology or something. There's something here that is different. And we're not fighting for religious theories. We're caught up in a power that is greater than ourselves. When we relate to that power, we have help. Not to necessarily solve all our problems, but to find footing, you see. It's like if you were out in the swamp, you see, and you don't know where's the quicksand and where's the solid ground, and your foot suddenly strikes the solid ground, you see, and you feel your way along, and on either side of you is quicksand, but there is that solid ground that you can walk on. And that is the thing when you tie up with Christ, that there, you find that there's something solid here, even though all the outward things are not there, you may not have a great life. And you may not get all your problems solved, but you begin to come to peace within and to realize that there is something to this universe besides idiocy and insanity. So now Paul comes in with a thought that if you have identified with the risen Christ, then you should seek the things that are above, where Christ is at the right hand of God, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your affection, set your mind. Now, the translation, set your affections, is really misplaced because we think of affections as some casual feelings. But he says rather here, let your mind focus on the things above, not on the earth. If you let that be your focus, your orientation. For you have died, and your life is hid with Christ in God. Whenever Christ appears, then our life, pardon me, Christ, who is our life, appears, then we also shall appear with him in glory, or you also shall appear with him in glory. A very reasonable conclusion. If the essential reality of the universe is spiritual, that is, with Christ, who has risen from the dead, and if we have identified with him, then our focus is what Christ is doing within us and what Christ intends to do in terms of the future eternity. That is more important to us, or really more vital, I should rather say, than how things come out on the earth. Because you see, the problem is, I've lived a long time. I've seen a lot of things, and I've talked to hundreds or probably thousands of people. If you would take counseling over a period of 30 years, I've probably talked to thousands of people. And one thing is a common denominator. That is that everybody makes mistakes. And everybody makes the kinds of mistakes that keep their life from ever really going back to the original starting point. You make decisions and choices that send your life in a direction, and you're not going to go back, ever. Even, for example, let us say, let's use a very neutral kind of thinking. Let us say, for example, that a person builds a career. They make a choice with a career. And so they graduate from college or high school, whichever. They launch upon their career, and they decide they've gotten they decide maybe the company they've gotten tied up with isn't the best, so they get an offer from another company, which is more money, and they quit this company and they go with the other company. Now, the other company, which was a lot more glamorous, turns out, as a matter of fact, to have a lot of problems in it, and so a year later the person decides finally he just can't take it anymore, and he quits the company the second one he went to work for. And he finds an opening in the company he left, and he goes back there. Now, are things really the same? Not quite. They're not really the same. You went back, but your loyalty is questionable, you know, after all. They don't know when you're going to go again for that sort of thing. Now, the more gutty thing, of course, has to do with human relationships, marriages and things like that. These things, you make your choices. I'd say probably most marriages are a mistake. I think they probably are. I think for the most part, people don't know what they're doing when they get married. And they make a mistake. What do you do about it? Or people make economic mistakes. Make mistakes in their decision. Now, years ago, I had a piece of property that I sold for a certain amount of money, and if I had hung on to that, it was not essential that I sell it, but things were tight. I decided to sell a piece of property. Today, if I had hung on to that piece of property, of course, it was a half acre in a residential community that is now a very high-class community. It would have been worth several hundred thousand dollars probably today. Oh, it was a mistake. And will I ever be able to go back to it? No, I'll never be able to recover that. Now, I say those things to say to you that as far as this life is concerned, it is filled with, it is not just, that doesn't just have mistakes in it, it is filled with mistakes of judgment and choice and so forth. We don't go back. We can never really go back. And even our mind changes. Our attitudes change. In fact, every choice you make sets up a new pattern within your brain which will forever affect all future choices. In one way or another, that choice you make will forever affect all future choices as far as the natural mind is concerned. What you have to do is take whatever you've got, commit it to Christ, and go on in your life with the best available option, but What we do is shift our emphasis. Once you realize that what you're in is a swamp in this world, you don't really look for a whole lot in that swamp but crocodiles. You know, in other words, it's there. What do you have out in your life tomorrow, the next day, and the next day? What's out there? I'd hate to really say, but there's not a whole lot out there. Nothing you can put any weight on. You may be the most joyous person in the world today, and tomorrow it can all be blown up. You just don't put weight on it. You can enjoy whatever you've got. I hope that you do. I hope that you have the good sense to take whatever you've got and be grateful for that, enjoy that, not expect anything beyond it too much. You know, you have something left, you have a child, have a situation of some kind that's there, that has some redeeming features in it. So accept it and go with it. Make the most out of what you've got, but don't put any weight on anything. What do you put weight on? You put weight on the fact that this whole earthly scene is spinning out into a catastrophe of one kind or another. But it doesn't really matter that much, because the reality of your life is with Christ. He's putting it together for us for eternity. Let's say here's a woman that she has a rotten marriage. Everything falls apart. And now she's struggling with the remains, pieces, marriage is gone, and now she's struggling with the pieces of it. Now, let us say, to bring a happy ending into it, that she meets some very tremendous individual, substantial, the very opposite of all that the disintegrated marriage was. And she is looking forward to a good, solid, happy, stable life. It does happen. I've been involved with some people where it has happened. Let's say that now, a month later, or 2 months later, or three, they're going to get married. There are no bugs in this. We'll fantasize that. That is a fantasy, but we'll fantasize. The guy is really all he claims to be, which is very unusual. Whatever money he says he has, he really has. He's substantial. He's not just freeloading. All his stocks are not tied up in securities in Switzerland, so he needs to borrow money to live on from his girlfriend. It's not that. It's real. It's substantial. But still, you see, in the present moment, for the next 3 months, let us say, suppose that he's off in Europe, concluding business matters, and he's going to come back in 3 months, and you're going to get married. But meanwhile, there are problems. Meanwhile, you're still living in a situation that's difficult. Things are a struggle and so forth. Now, are you going to try, is that girl going to try to solve and smooth out the problems pertaining to that broken situation? Or is she going to be thinking ahead in terms of the new situation? Is she going to try to find a Lonely Hearts Club to join? Is she going to try to go to, what is it, single parents or whatever you call it. Parents Without Partners. There's an organization called Parents Without Partners. Is she going to become president of the Parents Without Partners Club? You say, no, she's not going to get involved in any of that. Why? Because 3 months from now she's going to get married and it's going to be a whole new life. She's not going to be fighting desperately to put together pieces at any cost of what she now has. See? Now, I want to say to you, as an old hand at this thing, that for most people, putting together the pieces of what they now have is pretty difficult, and probably not too likely. But we should set our sights on the fact that the meaning of our life is in what Christ is preparing for us for eternity. Now, don't misunderstand me. I don't mean we should just forget about our earthly situation. Make the best of it. The girl living in the Coldwater flat is going to still continue to pay her rent and going to still continue to keep food coming on the table for her children or whatever, you see. She's going to keep living. He's just not going to put a whole lot into trying to reorganize that facet of her life. Now, see, I've talked to so many people who are just desperately trying to rescue something of value out of their present mistakes. It's not going to happen, for the most part. Not very easily. Occasionally, but not to you. So, you take what you've got and do the best you can with it. Extract the most out of it, whatever you've got now, and trust that as the Lord may have some changes, He'll direct that. Now, let us carry the analogy further. Let us say the fiancé wires from Europe and says, by the way, I've decided that you should not be living there. I'm wiring $1,000. I want you to pay the first and last month's rent on a new apartment over here. That's a different thing. That's a different story. Or he says, I don't like the school these children of yours are going to. I'm going to see to it they get into this private school over here. So you change. Whatever it is. He says, I think you need an automobile to get around with you. Whatever he may be able to put together for you, you're going to be so much the better for it, but you're going to do it as he puts it together for you or helps you with it. You're not going to appeal to an ex-boyfriend for a loan. that's gutty. Yeah, it's gutty. It's very real because it happens all around us all the time. So here is our life. See, Paul says if you are risen with Christ, you've got a new orientation. You've got a new life out there. Let that be the focus. What then will be the joy? Let's continue the analogy. What then will be the joy of this woman who has a fiancé and a new life ahead? It'll be letters back and forth to that person. Telephone calls, thoughts, dreams, something even more, a spiritual reality of hope. In other words, her joy and happiness will be no longer in these present circumstances, but in the hope and the interaction with the new situation. But for the present, that has to wait a little bit because he has to take care of business overseas. It may be 3 months or 6 months, perhaps. I think that's a very real analogy. It's exactly what Paul is saying here. If you're risen with Christ, seek the things that are above. Sure, maybe your life is in shreds here on the earth. It won't be very long before we have an eternity with Christ. Nothing is permanent. It's a good thing to keep in mind. Nothing is permanent on this earth. I counseled with a woman whose husband had been buried in a cave-in. The oxygen was cut off for a while, and when he came out, when he was rescued, he was alive, but there was, but he was in a coma, and he was in the coma. I have not been involved in that case for a year or so, but in the past, when I was involved in it, there was not a whole lot of hope of his coming out of the coma very soon, if ever. And she was faced with the prospect of living with this situation where the husband had to be cared for like a baby. They had special equipment and everything there, and he had to have a nurse and had to take care of him just in the home. They brought him home. I could give her this hope. Nothing is that permanent. Assume that there is 20 years out there. 20 years is not forever. Now you see, if all she had was this lifetime, then that might be different. Now, friends were saying to her, well, you know, you can't just bury yourself in that for 20 years. You'd be certainly justified to get him the proper care and divorce him and marry again and have a life for yourself. Because the attitude was he doesn't know what's going on anyway. So. But she didn't want to do that, and I understand it. But the point was this. Was she sentenced to nothing else in all of life but this? Is that going to be all that her life would ever consist of? No. Even if it was 20 more years, the day was coming when this earth would be through. Her life on this earth would be over. And then the new thing would begin. And even now, she could find her joy in the presence of Christ with her and in his strength and so forth in her life. So there are lots of people in this world that would be sentenced to a lifetime of tragedy. People who are crippled with multiple sclerosis, for example. People who are in the wheelchair and they'll never get out as long as they're on this earth. The paraplegics, whatever, you know, never going to be different on this earth. But their hope is that that's all that they're going to have to be sentenced to. Not, that isn't everything in life. I mean, that's only a temporary period. Now, if one did not believe in God, if one did not believe in eternity with Him, then you'd have to say this was an unutterable tragedy because there was nothing else for them at all ever but that tragedy. And that would be unbearable. But no matter what your circumstances are, even if you have to live with them as long as you're on this earth, they're not going to be, it isn't going to be that much longer. But you see, the point we're making is whatever the pieces are that you are left with of your life right now in this world, don't assume that they've got to come back together before. If you really love Christ, you know, don't assume that the Christian is going to get those pieces all back together. On the other hand, know that that is only a temporary thing and that your real life is with Christ. Your joy is, or your peace of mind perhaps, or your satisfaction is not in trying to fit all these pieces together, but in being with Him, being at peace with Him, and letting Him be the judge of what He wants to put together. And what He doesn't. That's where the essence of this is. What does He want you to have? As far as the interim, the time you're here. And that's where that analogy comes in. Here's the person that's away. He's the fiancé. He's going to put it all together for you ultimately. How much does He want to put together for you right now? So, for example, He could say, here's the girl is working. She'd like very much to quit. But His reasoning is, well, if she quits, what'll she do? She just have to sit around and wait. Might as well keep working. So instead of sending her, which he could, enough money each month so she doesn't have to work, he decides she better just keep her job till they finally get married. He is the guide of what gets put together and what doesn't, what gets changed and what doesn't. Let Him be the judge of what needs to be put together on this earth for us. He comes. And I look at this matter of marriages, and I, as you know, I've spent just great numbers of years at the matter of marriages, and I think that for the most part, the expectations that have been laid out before us may be too much. I think the expectations are such that people assume that a happy marriage is next to godliness, you know. We have to say it's next to impossible. Given the human nature, given the demand for rights, given the demand for self-interest, given all of these things, it's difficult for two people to live together in contentment. Now, all I really mean by that is, if you have to struggle the rest of your life with a situation that is not an idyllic marriage, for example, you may tend to feel deprived and say, well, surely I must not have to do that. Surely the Lord wants me to have a nice marriage. I don't know whether He does or not. Maybe you're better off the way you are. Now, for example, we'll be very specific, very pointed. Suppose that a person who is in a difficult marriage situation, maybe there's a woman who's a Christian, a husband's a non-Christian. Normally, my word to them is that as far as divorce is concerned, you let the other person get the divorce, or at any rate be absolutely convinced within yourself that that's the thing that the Lord wants you to do. In other words, you pray and ask the Lord to help you put the thing together the way He wants it. I've used a specific which I probably shouldn't use because I can't generalize. I shouldn't generalize. But what I'm really saying is, instead of just deciding that you've got to change your situation, either A, to get out of a marriage, or B, to get in one, instead of just deciding to do it and going about to do it, you work in conjunction with Christ. That is to say, you pray to Him. You don't go willfully down the road and say, well, I'm going to do this no matter what Christ thinks. But you pray about it each day, and if you're not clear in your mind, you wait. If you don't know that this is what Christ wants you to do, you wait. If you think it's what He wants you to do, you do it. Now you say to me, well, I don't know how to get guidance from Christ. Well, part of that is the consistency of staying with Him. In other words, if you day by day are in the habit of praying, talking to the Lord, taking Him into your confidence, asking Him about your decisions, if you're accustomed to doing that, it'll be less difficult to know than if you sometimes involve yourself with Him and sometimes not. It's like in another kind of an analogy, let us say the husband is going to buy his wife a Christmas present, but he only sees her occasionally. You know, he never spends any time with her, pops in on occasion. Now, he's not going to know what to buy her for a Christmas present, because he doesn't know her. He doesn't spend enough time with her to know her. He may have to ask her mother or something. Same thing with Christ. There are no magic formula for getting guidance from Christ, but the more time you spend with Him, the more sensitive you are to what He wants. And if you're just off and on with Him, it's not going to be easy. But there are lots of different ways He has to guide you in these matters. And one of the things is that if you're interested in doing what He wants, and you're open to Him, if you go to make a decision that He doesn't want, you'll feel a check about it. You just won't feel at ease to do that. And so you'll wait. Just wait. Or if it's something that He wants you to do, you'll find a continual prodding to do it. It'll be in your mind, and you'll feel uneasy until you do it. There is that reality of being guided by Christ. The first hurdle, though, is being willing to do whatever it is He wants. Or letting the focus be on not on how to have a nice life, but how to fulfill what it is that Christ wants, meanwhile, while we're on the earth. And not to expect anything great. See, not to expect that knowing Christ is going to get all your problem solved, or put all the pieces together, because they may not go together. But I'm trying to give you the realization that everybody's life has pieces in it that don't go together very well on the earth. Sometimes the storybook lives are not as storybook as they may appear to be. Maybe the story is what people are covering up the reality with. See, I'm saying that don't look for a whole lot. Don't expect that Jesus is going to solve all your problems. But do, on the other hand, take it a day at a time as you sense that it is what He wants, and let your chief focus be not how can I have a nice life, but how can I follow Christ? How can I satisfy what He wants for me on the earth right now? Well, we'll pray.